Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to The Andy Pin Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
It is cool. We are back on The Andy Pin Show. And the Fin Man is here with Robin.
Hello.
And we want to talk a little bit about politics. So Barack Obama announced his national security team this week. He announced his financial team last week. And this week they rolled out the heavy hitters. We have Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Robert Gates is staying on for at least a year, roughly a year, in the Pentagon. And he announced his national security advisor is the retired general whose name escapes me.
James Jones.
We don't want to confuse him with Jimmy Jones.
No, nobody's drinking Kool-Aid.
No, well, they might be, but there's nothing in it that'll really harm you. We're hoping. So, do you have an opinion about the choice of Hillary and then the decision of Hillary to go into the Obama cabinet?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful idea. I think she's brilliant. I think he's... my father said he was a little reticent about Obama. He was for Hillary.
Now, your dad, we need to give him some context. Yeah. Your dad
is a retired Foreign Service
Foreign Service. So he has been around. He's 95 years old.
Yes.
In fact, he had his birthday just four days ago.
Yeah, November 27th.
But he's 95. He's been around the world. He's been in the Foreign Service. He's seen presidents come and go.
Yes.
And he's a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat.
Yes.
But supported Hillary initially, took to Obama slowly.
Yes, exactly.
Perfect.
Beautifully put. But he said that he felt that the choices that Obama has made so far are splendid. And that's a word that my father doesn't use very often.
So he didn't really think the Bush administration has been splendid?
Excuse me.
I suppose not.
Oh, God.
Well, okay, so, it's interesting. You know, when you tune in the political shows or the cable television shows, what you're going to get is a political analysis. So very few people talk about how good she'll be or what she'll do as Secretary of State. They talk more about, can Obama control her? Will she be a loose cannon? Will Bill Clinton be a loose cannon? Will she have her own foreign policy? I don't really worry about that stuff.
I don't either. Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw Christopher Hitchens tonight on Hardball.
I enjoy him.
You would have hated this.
How did I miss that?
You would have hated this because Christopher Hitchens was there basically claiming that Hillary, he made the point that, well, first of all, she's not qualified to be Secretary of State, he claims.
Huh.
Secondly.
Well, he's always interesting.
Yes, exactly.
He's interesting.
He's a provocateur.
Yes, exactly.
But he also argues that the Clintons are only interested in
power.
In themselves and what they can do, so that she will not be furthering Barack Obama's agenda, or to the extent she is, she's also at the same time looking out for herself big time. Now, see, I give her more credit than that. I don't know why all politicians have egos. All politicians look out for themselves. Some are worse than others. But the idea that somehow the Clintons are so much worse than all the other politicians I've seen in my lifetime, I just don't see the evidence for that.
Mm-mm.
What about Nixon? Let's go back to somebody like Nixon. Hitchens may say, fine, you've picked the worst president in recent history.
Before Bush.
Well, that's true. Nixon had some things going for him. It's too bad he was a crook.
Yeah, and a sick personality.
Well, he had an enemies list.
Well, I don't know. And I don't understand why people, a lot of my right-wing Republican friends, just have this visceral reaction to Hillary Clinton. And they'll say, oh, she's evil. And, you know, I just don't know where it comes from. I think in the atmosphere that we're in, I mean, I really do think that, I'm sort of a Pollyanna at this point, but I've just got to believe that that they're going to really do the right thing and do a good job. And I think Obama is strong enough. You know, he says, I have the vision. I'm going to be the one who's... He doesn't say I'm the decider. He just says change is resides
yes,
with me.
Yeah, you're, and it's a good point to talk about. He was asked last week when he announced his financial team, and then he announced Paul Volcker as his part of his backup financial team, essentially, a second set of advisors he would turn to make sure the first group don't go too far off kilter. Mm-hmm. They said, the reporter asked me, he said, where is the change we can believe in? You're bringing back all the same old people. And he said, oh, well, the change comes from me. I set the vision for this administration. Yeah. I'll worry about the change. Mm-hmm. What I want is competent people in there, and they will put in place my policies. Yeah. And George Bush listened to that, and he said, why didn't I think of that? Put competent people in place.
Oh, no. God, there was this wonderful, in Rolling Stone, I read this wonderful, or was it in
The Economist.
I don't remember where I saw it.
It's either Rolling Stone or The Economist.
Oh, God.
Sarah Palin reads The Economist, you know.
She does not.
She claims she does.
When? She never made any claims. She doesn't read. She doesn't read newspapers.
She never said that. She reads them all.
Oh, that's right.
She reads them all.
She reads them all, but she couldn't name
it. I want it all.
Gotcha.
Or nothing at all.
Well, George Bush, there was this wonderful quote that I read that I can't remember.
I'm sure I can repeat it. I've got them indelibly marked on my brain.
But he surrounds himself with people who just, anyway.
I think he surrounds himself with no men.
Yes.
And the context in which I mean that is that there was a great article in the Washington Post this morning, and it talked about, it's one by one, every day they're looking at a different cabinet position. And today they're looking at labor secretary. So they're looking at the possibilities for labor secretary, mm-hmm. who the leading candidates might be, and then what the current state of the Labor Department is. And the headline on the inside article is Labor Department Accused of Straying from Enforcement. And basically it's about the fact that the Labor Department has not been enforcing standards about wage and hour laws and about workplace safety. Mm-hmm. And this is what happens. I'll give you another example, and that is that the article on the Interior Department and EPA, which was in last Friday's Washington Post, the headline said, EPA Interior Department chiefs will be busy erasing Bush's mark. Now, it is true that every president that comes in, when you change parties, the other side wants to erase some of what the group did. Mm-hmm. But the problem with this...
Were they Russian regulations that before they get out?
Yeah, and in fact, right now, the Bush administration is doing quite a bit of that. In fact, they're being very cagey because if a regulation is in place 60 days, it's much harder to change than if you catch it in the first 60 days. So the Bush administration has made it a point to get most of this done before November 22nd, which was 60 days before the Obama inauguration.
Mm-hmm. And so they did a lot of them on November 19th.
They've done a lot of them already. But what this gets down to is an interesting argument that the left has been making, and I'm still waiting for a good answer from one of my Republican friends. I've not heard anyone address this directly. I've heard radio talk show hosts dance around it and claim that it's poppycock, but... And it's this, and it's that, why would you elect Republicans to run the government since they believe that the government is the source of the problem most of the time, so they don't actually believe in government. They don't believe government can accomplish anything and that it can be run well. And then you put them in charge of running it well, and they run it poorly, witness Katrina. And but the Bush administration's a bit of an exception. But the argument is that Republicans don't govern well because they don't actually believe in governance. And I think it's a really interesting argument. And if you go back to the Nixon administration, Nixon wanted his way, and he was a moderate Republican, but he would, if he was going to appoint one minority to his cabinet, he might put them in charge of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and say, you know, I don't really care about housing and urban development that much. If you want to make a difference there, go for it. And he got out of their way and let them do what they wanted to do. But by the time we got to, and that was true in a variety of departments, and it was true for Republicans and Democrats in various administrations. It shifted, as far as I'm concerned, with the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan put people like James Watt at Interior. James Watt was a shill for mining and gas and oil interests, and was intent on undoing regulation. And the Reagan administration came in saying they would undo as much regulation as they could. Mm-hmm. And he put people in that didn't believe in the mission of the organization. And I think there's something fundamentally wrong about that. We have an Interior Department for a reason. If you want to slow down the rate at which we set aside acreage for national parks and for forest preserves and things like that, then as your president, you can slow it down. But you don't get to, you shouldn't get to reverse the will of the people. These things are in place for a while. If you can kill the energy department, I'm sorry, or the energy, commerce, or education, which Reagan said he wanted to kill and he wasn't able to, then kill it. But in general, there's a mission for these organizations. Put someone in charge that believes in the fundamental mission, will enforce the law, and then if you want to change it, go ahead and change it. But instead what they do is they put people in charge who don't actually believe in the mission, and then they drive it into a ditch, metaphorically. And of course, it doesn't usually come back to bite you unless you go on national television and say, "Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job." And that cost Bush big time.
Yeah.
But anyway, so in the course of this shift, there's going to be some of these changes going on. And the last little item I want to deal with here, Robin, before we go to break, is whether or not Barack Obama is still smoking. Now, Michael Kinsley, who's a Democrat essentially, but a liberal columnist, wrote an op-ed in the editorial going back, about a week and a half. Mm-hmm. And I read it at the time, and he said that there are indications that Obama may still be smoking. Now, he hasn't smoked in public in months, but
What indications?
Well, I don't even remember. I think the fact that he seems cool, calm, and collected under pressure, he must be smoking. I'm not sure. There may be some behind-the-scenes reports. He may disappear from time to time. Mm-hmm. I mean, frankly, you can smell it on someone's breath. You can't get rid of all evidence of smoke.
Or you can smell it standing next to them.
On the other hand, he now is in a bubble. Mm-hmm. Right, he's in the Secret Service bubble, so
and they won't tell.
They shouldn't, and so maybe people would not know.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, Kinsley made the point that so what if he may be smoking still and hiding it from us? But look, let's cut him some slack. He's going to have the toughest job in the world, and it's going to be under stress. If he wants to light up, don't give him a hard time about it. You know, give him a light and look the other way was kind of the way he closed the article. Mm-hmm. Well, then a couple of people wrote in about this and made the assumption that he is smoking, and then they had a pro and a con about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's setting a bad example, or you know, let's let him go. At least he's not a former cocaine using alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Or a pot smoker or whatever else that mm-hmm. Our last couple of presidents have been doing in their spare time before they became president. So, well, what do you think about a smoking president?
Well, I've had, I think 3 or 4 people in my family die from cancer due to cigarette smoking, secondhand or firsthand smoke. So, I feel very strongly when I'm with people that I insist that they don't smoke. Now I don't think I'm going to have the opportunity to be with our president-elect and tell him in my presence that I would prefer that he not smoke. But I wonder if I would. So that's my opinion.
Well, I want evidence that he's smoking.
Right.
I think he may have given it up. You know, it doesn't bother me if he hasn't. I think it is a hard habit to break.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see why he'd want to hide it from the American people.
Mm-hmm. And it's harder and harder to break. I stopped smoking in 73, I think. But just like that.
It's not
but,
that. It's
but
not,
now they're putting more and more nicotine in it. And
it's not that hard to smoke. I've quit dozens of times. Actually, I smoked twice in my life. I didn't smoke as a young person. They say when you start young, uh-huh. that's when it gets you. If you start as a teenager, it's very hard to quit.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't smoke till I was in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I claimed it was the graduate pressure. School. Exactly. And I started then, and I quit the day we got in a vehicle to drive to Missouri and move on to my PhD program, because I said I was using cigarettes as an excuse to smoke all through my master's program, and if I didn't quit, I'd use it all through my PhD program. So uh-huh. I quit the day that we got in the U-Haul truck and drove the whole damn family, the whole fam-damily, out to St. Louis.
Oh, I'm so proud from you, as my German friends would say.
And then I started up again later. Uh-huh. I moved to Kentucky, and actually it was when I was going through a divorce.
But also,
I was surrounded by people that smoke. Kentucky, people smoke. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd go out with a group of friends, faculty members, graduate students. I'd sit around. And one night, I was sitting around with eight people. Seven of them were smokers and me. I started bumming cigarettes because I never told myself that I could never have another cigarette. Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to do, of course. Mm-hmm. And so I would bum one.
To be around someone who's smoking. I mean, I now, if you stand next to someone in an elevator,
yep.
I can smell.
Yeah, yeah. They put out the cigarette and come inside and think.
I don't care. It's you.
Right. You have it. That's right.
It's in their clothes,
yes,
their veins, their skin.
Their veins.
Well, I don't know.
You can smell their veins?
No, but I can smell their skin. I can smell
it on
their skin.
It's on the clothes and the hair and everything.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I started bumming cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Now, when was this?
From, this would have been, let's see, 96 to 97.
Mm-hmm.
And so I turned to Kirk and said, hey, can I have a cigarette? And can I have another cigarette? And finally he turned to me and said, you should buy a pack. And I said, what do you mean? I'm just bumming a few. He says, you got to face facts. You're a smoker. And so that helped me. And mm-hmm. I did buy packs for a while,
mm-hmm.
and I had started up again. And then I said, no, I got to quit. And then what I realized was I can never have another cigarette. And I hadn't made that promise to myself mm-hmm. before. Now I have, because I toyed with it and got burned.
Well, I dream about smoking, but I've never been tempted since I just gave it up, 1973, I think. But I dream about it all the time and imagine that I can pick up a cigarette, but it never occurs to me in real life.
Interesting.
Never. I never think about it.
You have a rich fantasy life.
I do.
When we come back, we'll hear more about it.
Get your hands off that mouse. The Andy Finn Show will be right back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah!
I've often thought that if our brains got physically larger the more we exercised them, that instead of going to the gym to pump iron, people would go to the library to pump ideas in order to impress the opposite sex.
Look at the brain on that stud.
Have you ever seen a brain that big?
Look at that guy. He's huge.
I gotta start working out my head.
Wow. I'd like to wake up next to that brain every morning.
So tune in The Andy Finn Show and grow your brain.
Okay.
It's the only one you've got.
Listen to The Andy Finn Show at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us.
We are back on The Andy Finn Show, and the Finn Man is here with Robin. Hello, Robin.
Hello.
Today is December 1st, and it was on this date in 1986 that President Ronald Reagan said that he would welcome an investigation of the Iran-Contra affair if it were recommended by the Justice Department. He would welcome it. Yeah, nobody welcomes an investigation. No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. And let's see. The British and French workers finally met under the English Channel as they were digging the Channel Tunnel.
Oh, the Channel.
On this date, the Channel. Mm-hmm. They actually got the dig done. And guess what year this was, folks? Think about this. What year did they finish? They met. They didn't finish the Channel, but they had finished the digging, so they met in the center. Hmm. I assume it was near the center. 1990. Can you believe that? It was 18 years ago. Of course, it didn't open right away. It took another few years to open.
And did the big dig in Boston start at the same time and still not finished?
Close. It started before 80, before 90. The big dig actually did start before then.
Mm.
Well, maybe not. It was 14 years in the making, so it was right about 90. Yeah. Mm. One other little topic that's worth mentioning. This was the date in 1969 that the government held the first draft lottery since World War II.
That was for Vietnam.
It was for Vietnam. We hadn't had a lottery before then, but we were needing more troops. And, they could see the light at the end of the tunnel. They were turning the corner and all those euphemisms for victory. And, of course, we must have peace with honor and never peace with surrender. And so we started enlisting more of our young boys. It was only boys back then.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting was that I was part of this whole thing. Now, in 69, they just chose the lottery for the people that turned 18 that year. Then the next year, they held a lottery for everyone who had a deferment. And that included all of us who were in college, and I was in college, and we all sat around and listened to the radio as they drew numbers.
Wow.
And they drew 365 times, and they drew 365 different days of the year. And if you talk to people from my generation who were in college in that era, everyone remembers their draft numbers. Women don't, because you don't need to know it. But my draft number was 126. Now, what they used to say in the beginning was that about a third of the numbers would be sure to go, would be sure to get drafted. That is, about number 1 to 120 would be sure to go. About the last third, the last 120 numbers, wouldn't go. And the middle 120, they didn't know, but they would get through a lot of them. They'd get through half of them or more. And so that was the thing. Well, 126 is just past the first third. And so it looked like you would. It looked like I was going when I got this draft number chosen. I had two. We had a bunch of friends that I lived with at the time, and one of them had a number three. One of them drew number three. One of them drew number 10. Both of these guys were. One of them had double curvature of the spine. One of them had flat feet. They had deferments. They had met. Another one who had a low number had bad knees. All three of them who had low numbers got deferments. Bernie Robson, one of my best friends, had number 310 or something. He got lucky. I think Denny got lucky. And I was in no man's land. I was one of the people who looked like I'd be likely to go. So by my senior year, I went down to the National Guard, and I thought to myself, why not pull a George Bush and a Dan Quayle?
But it wasn't a George Bush or a Dan Quayle then.
No, we didn't.
It was
Andy
Finn.
It was an Andy Finn, meaning I went on my own. I didn't have my father and my family to get me into the pilot's program. And so I took the intelligence exam, or whatever they called it, the aptitude test. And the guy called me afterwards that I did really well, and he wanted me to sign up. And I said, well, I'm going to hold off and wait. Because what had happened was, in the first year of the draft, they had gotten to like 190. And then the first year after my number was chosen.
And you were 186, so it was
and
already.
I was 126.
126.
And so the next year they got to like 150. Well, now I'm a senior, and the question was, how high would they get? Would they get to 126 the year I was getting out? And they didn't. So I didn't go down and join the National Guard, and I forever ruined my opportunities to be president of the United States. Well, that and all that stuff I was doing that Bush and Clinton were doing, too. Studying.
Oh.
Studying hard.
Well, not Bush.
No-dose. I was addicted to no-dose. Just pulling those all-nighters and cramming those books. In any case, we are going to move on to a little segment we call Wackos, Bunkos, and Locos.
Do you feel inferior? Do you sometimes think you're not as bright as the rest of us? The Andy Finn Show has the cure. Listen to stories about some real idiots. Yes, it's time for another edition of Wackos, Bunkos, and Locos. Tales of the not so bright among us.
Well, Robin, what do we have in the line of either Wackos, Bunkos, or Locos this week?
Well, let's see. I don't know which one we would call this, but one recent item that I found was in the Independent newspaper in London. New Brassiere technology. The Brazilian designer Lucia Lorio introduced women's lingerie in October, containing a global positioning device to enable the wearer to be tracked by satellite.
You got to be kidding me.
The creator said the password-protected lace bodice would make it easier for women kidnapped by thugs or terrorists to be located and rescued. But critics called it a virtual chastity belt of greatest service to insecure males wanting to track their own women. And it was discovered that the wearer can manually turn the device off.
Well, then they don't have to be tracked. It's like you're.
Well, maybe you want to be.
Maybe. And the other thing is, what do you do if you go out with a woman who doesn't wear a brassiere, doesn't wear a bodice,
a lace bodice? Well.
You know, I guess you require your wife to wear certain clothes.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's a smashing idea. I will have to see.
I'm going to run out and get one, but I have to find someone who will track me.
Oh, I think there's people who would track you.
Volunteers?
Absolutely. I'd volunteer in a New York minute.
Well, let's see. There's something else. This is from the Sacramento Bee, and it's about the California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you want to hear about that?
Oh, absolutely, because he's got a big budget problem.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And this is what that's about. So, facing a state budget crisis in July, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger fired about 10,000 temporary and part-time workers and ordered the 200,000 permanent employees to be paid only the minimum wage of $6.55 an hour until the legislature passed a crisis-solving budget. However, a week later, the state controller, John Chiang, pointed out that state payroll records could not be changed to accommodate the cut because they are written in the antiquated COBOL computer language, and virtually the only state employees who knew the code were some of the part-timers Schwarzenegger had just fired.
It happens. Well, one of the things that's interesting about languages like COBOL is we still have all these legacy systems, huge systems that are complex in the government, but we had them at AT&T, and they still have them at AT&T, and they are just you can't just turn them off and build a new system. They've been built up over decades, and they cost millions of dollars to change out. So corporations are stuck with them too, but government especially.
Were those the systems that we were so afraid would crash when 1999?
Yes, absolutely. This was part of the Y2K problem because they only had two digits for the year. Yeah, I still got 3 years worth of bottled water in my basement from that problem. I was sure that when the clocks went crazy, we'd all run out of water. I don't know why. Okay, one more.
Okay, let's see. Researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison said that they had developed new technology that would detect breast enhancement cheating at beauty contests. The researchers are veterinarians, and the relevant contests are show cows at dairy exhibits, where the cheating involves making the cow's udders fuller, smoother, and more symmetrical. Note that 40% of the contestants' grade is based on udder integrity. Unlike their human beauty contest counterparts, though, cow udders are valued only for milk-producing potential.
Well, I'm sure that's true. And who knew? In any case, Adam is here for the next episode of Midnight Mutants, and so we are going to make ourselves scarce. That'll do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. Thank you, Robin.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
It's been lovely. And we will be back. Finn Man and Robin will be back next week for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. We have a special guest next week, a very smart academic type fella who knows something about elections.
Oh.
Until next week, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.